The state of Tennessee is one of the few places where the sounds are just as breathtaking as the sights.
Whether that's live music at an historic music venue, the crack of an open fire at a campsite in the wilderness, or hearing kids laugh as they explore what's right around the bend, Tennessee just sounds perfect.
Start planning your trip at tnvacation.com. Tennessee sounds perfect.
This episode is brought to you by the movie The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, only in theaters April 19th. Get tickets now.
It's directed by Guy Ritchie, who did The Gentlemen, and produced by Jerry Bruckheimer, who did Top Gun Maverick.
Based on a true story, this action comedy reveals the first ever Special Forces mission executed during World War II.
Starring Henry Cavill and Alan Ritchson, discover how one mission changed history, laying the foundation for modern Black Ops warfare.
The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare is rated R and in theaters April 19th. Get tickets now.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Well, by now you know what that music means. Welcome to the show, Ridiculous Historians. It's hopefully your favorite non-history experts coming to you relatively live from our respective bunkers yet again. Hi, my name's Ben.
What does it mean, Ben? What does it mean? The music.
It means that our show is still on, Noel. We're recording an episode now. And I got to say, we are upping our camera game. All three of us look pretty great from what I can see on the screens.
Yeah, well, it's the parts that you can't see on the screen that should concern you, my friend.
There we go.
Maybe concern is a strong word, but, you know, working from home is a slippery slope. You know, putting on pants really does become optional.
Yep, agreed. As a matter of fact, I was talking to one of my friends who is a no-fooling kind of productivity expert, and one of her big recommendations for people working from home is that when you wake up in the morning, you go ahead and get dressed like you're going somewhere. It kind of primes your brain.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I've had a hard time with that. I don't know about you.
I've been rocking more of like a sort of a sweatsuit situation, and I've been starting my day off with a nice walk, and so it's appropriate, the sweatsuit for that, but then I just keep it on for the rest of the day. Is that weird?
No, not at all, man. Not
that
at all.
That pregnant pause.
I hope that was just the lag in our communication, because I was going to say, you know, you're really doing a favor for the sweatsuit industry, because if people on the street see Noel Brown rocking a sweatsuit, their first question is immediately going to be, what? How can I get one? So you're welcome, sweatsuits.
Hey, thank you, Ben, for giving me that that confidence boost. I appreciate it.
So I was thinking of an interesting segue in here, and I wanted to see what you and our super producer, Casey Pegram, thought about this. A lot of people, now that we're at home or self-isolating, a lot of us have been cooking more and more. You've been cooking, Noel. I've been cooking. Casey, I don't know. Have you been trying your hand at the pot and the pan?
My cooking repertoire consists of such delicacies as frozen pizzas. Let's see what else. We got some Eggo waffles in the mix. We got some wings. We did wings the other night. But no, my girlfriend is a great cook, and so she's been handling most of the duties. I help out where I can, but she's the expert.
Well, that's nice. You know, we all have our strengths.
Mm-hmm. And we can all agree that whether you consider yourself a top-notch chef or an amateur or just a cooking enthusiast, people love food. And wherever you go in the world, that's one of the topics that you can easily talk to anyone about, regardless of your cultural differences. Here in the United States, we've had a very old saying for a long time, which is the best thing since sliced bread. We've all like heard of that before, I'm sure. But today's show actually does concern sliced bread. Isn't that right?
It is right, but I got a bone to pick with this whole concept. Is slicing bread really that hard? With a nice serrated knife, they make a thing called a bread knife. It's literally part of any good cutlery arrangement.
Yeah. I think it's not so much that it's hard as much as people are thinking, you know, this is time consuming. I'm nickel and diming away my precious seconds of life, you know?
Yeah, sort of like the argument Gilbert Godfrey makes about the shoedini, you know? All the time you're wasting putting on your shoes like a regular person, 1 foot at a time. You could be like, you know, curing. It's too soon. You could be doing something productive with that time.
There we go. Good save. So today's story is so weird. We're going to go ahead and give you the big scoop, the lay of the land. As any longtime listener knows, you can get a lot of spoilers from checking out our titles and our descriptions. This is a story about that time the U.S. government banned sliced bread, and it's a weird journey.
It's a journey that begins around 1928 with a jeweler from Missouri by the name of Otto F. Rawetter. Rawetter? I don't know. I'm going to go with Rawetter. What do you think, Ben?
I went with Rawetter. So if we split the difference, at some point we will at the very least accidentally get the name right.
Yeah, exactly. Our pronunciation powers or lack thereof combined. But yeah, this gentleman, he saw a need. He saw a need that needed filling. He was overhearing, you know, homemakers in his jewelry store complaining about just how difficult it was to slice bread and how much they hated it. It was just the thing they just looked forward to the least. And what a hassle of American life it was to cut bread. So he looked at this and took it very seriously, and he saw an opportunity for innovation. And he invented a delightful gadget known as the automatic bread slicing machine and became something of an American hero, at least in the kitchen. But a little background about our boy Otto. I'm going to just call him Otto so I don't even have to mess with that pronunciation ever again. Otto was he was a bit of a Renaissance man. He was an ophthalmologist who decided to get into the jewelry game. And he owned not one, not two, but three jeweler stores in St. Joseph, Missouri. Missouri? Can you only say Missouri if you're from there? That seems accurate. What do you think, Ben?
I don't know. It's kind of like how people from Nevada say Nevada. You know, I wonder if it's something you have to earn. You're right. You're right, though, Noel. Rawetter was a trained ophthalmologist who went into jewelry for the money, and historians speculate that while he was selling earrings and necklaces, he overheard customers doing something like you would see at the beginning of a lot of TV infomercials now, where like picture someone trying to slice bread and the bread falls to the floor in the kitchen and they drop the knife.
If only there were another way.
Yes, there's got to be a better way. He tapped into that, really. No fooling. And we know that as early as 1912, he had built out a prototype for what would become his automatic bread slicer. And his big question was, he was like, well, what do we mean when we say a slice? What's the difference between a slice of bread and a slab of bread or a sliver of bread? So he did something very smart. He made a questionnaire, like a survey, and instead of handing it out to people in person, he paid to get it published in several newspapers in the region and the country. And then in just a few months, more than 30,000 people responded and let him know where they fell along the controversial issue of thick or thin slices.
Well, I have a question. Why can't they do it like they do with those deli slicer machines where you could pick your thickness? It's a variable thickness. Is that too much to ask, Otto? You only get one thickness?
Yeah, wouldn't it be neat to have a dial on the machine? You know, like how you can decide how toasted your toast is in a lot of toasters, you know?
That's right.
Well, unfortunately for him, we weren't there. Or maybe the technology wasn't there yet.
I think the technology might not have been there. So it's true. More than 30,000 housewives responded and indicated that they wanted a bread slice that was neither too thick nor too thin. Sort of a Goldilocks bread slice.
Mm-hmm.
That was just right. Although that is kind of relative, isn't it?
I guess so. So probably what he did was take like the biggest group consensus and went with that, because we know he for some reason couldn't make a variable bread slicing machine, and he went all in, dude. Like 4 years later, just was at 1916, he has sold off his entire jewelry business. He's taken the winnings from that. He got a workshop in an abandoned warehouse, and he started trying to make his bread slicer, but something terrible happened the very next year.
It's true. Disaster struck in 1917 in the form of a warehouse fire that engulfed in flame his prototype, along with all of his early drawings and blueprints, and all of the time that he had invested into this endeavor. But he was unshaken, unflapped, and he got back to work, even though he was set back like almost a decade, which to me would, I don't know, I would move on. Maybe, I don't know. It's the whole sunken cost fallacy thing, but he really believed in this product. So in 1928, he had you know, made up for all this lost time. You got to think that he had to have learned some lessons from it, even if they were just filed away in his memory banks, right? It wouldn't have been all for naught. But he got back on his feet in 1928, and he had a fully working machine, not a prototype, the real deal. And not only did it slice bread, but it wrapped it as well. Did we talk about the original expression that led to the best thing since sliced bread?
We haven't yet. Lay it on us.
Yeah, the original expression was the best thing since wrapped bread. So his thing was like the best thing, the double best thing, because it could wrap bread and slice bread.
Mm-hmm.
But you couldn't pick a variable thickness. You think he would have taken that 10 years to come up with that? I'm sorry. I'm going to leave Otto alone. He's suffered enough.
There's a lot of soul searching that he went through, you know, and good for him. It reminds me of that Rudyard Kipling poem, If, which is, Rudyard Kipling's a terrible person, but my God, that's a great poem. So you're right. We know that he did successfully, after a total of 14, 15 years of struggle, he did get his machine on the market. And the first ever pre-sliced loaf of bread went on sale on July 7th, 1928, when Frank Bench, who is a guy who knew Rowetter personally, took a chance. He bought a bread slicing machine and he installed it at his baking company in Missouri. The original name was Sliced Clean Made Bread. That's clean spelled K-L-E-E-N.
God, I love that. I love it when people take a word and for just no real reason spell it with a K or a Q or a Z.
I don't know, man. It freaks me out. Like, here in the South, you can find a lot of little mom and pop restaurants that call themselves some variety of like country cooking with two K's. Yeah. And that always weirded me out. I don't trust it. I don't know why, but I don't.
There's a place around the corner for me called Da Corner Cafe. And the corner is spelled with a K and cafe is spelled with a K, inexplicably. Like, are they trying to communicate some level of quirkiness that's going to translate it to their food? Like, oh yeah, I want a quirky breakfast sandwich, you know?
No, I'm right there with you. I remember, this has nothing to do with the episode, but I remember growing up, some of my more conspiratorially minded friends would be like, hey, Ben, all the businesses that put those K's in there, they're signaling that they're pro Ku Klux Klan. And that seemed like a reach. That's like that old conspiracy about the band 311. You remember that one?
Well, 311 was an inside job.
Right. And
that's an Eric Andre ripoff. I didn't make that up. Please go on. No, it was KKK, 11th letter,
yeah,
three times.
Yeah.
311's about the least white super. They're just a bunch of white dudes trying to play reggae. I mean, that might be a little culturally appropriative, but I don't think it's terroristic.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say at least you have the official word from us here at Ridiculous History. We are 98% sure 311 is not a front for the Ku Klux Klan.
Let's put this to rest. Casey Pegram, what do you think? 311 terrorist or non-terrorist?
I was about to say yes. perhaps aesthetic terrace. But no, I think their intentions are relatively pure.
All right, fair enough.
Oh, Casey on the case. Dun. Been a while since we did one of these. I miss it. So, like you said, that original statement calling this bread the greatest forward step in the baking industry since bread was wrapped came from an advertisement. But apparently, people didn't cotton to it right off the jump. There's a fascinating book by an author named Don Voorhees called Why Do Donuts Have Holes? Fascinating Facts About What We Eat and Drink. And according to Don, when these loaves were originally sold, people kind of didn't want to buy them because they thought they looked sloppy. They thought they looked, you know, kind of gross. They didn't look like neatly sliced. And they also seemed to go stale faster. Did you see that too, Noel?
No, but I know it to be true. And they also, well, I don't know, it depends. There's so many preservatives in loaf bread that you buy at the store now. If you do tend to buy a nice loaf of bread from a local baker, which don't come pre-sliced, you can usually ask them to slice them for you, but those will go stale and or moldy quicker than a store-bought loaf will because of all the preservatives.
Oh, yeah, good point. Rowetter still didn't give up, and I think this is inspiring. Otto said, okay, they think my bread's sloppy? They think I got a lackluster loaf? I'll show them. And he made these pins that are shaped like the capital letter U, and they would hold the loaf together so that when people went and saw it on the shelf, it would look, you know, more uniform, less haphazard. And apparently that worked.
I see. So the issue with the sloppiness is more an optics thing on the shelf. Like you're looking in the bag of bread and it's all just willy nilly, just kind of like, you know, a loaf is meant to be held together and it has this sort of very comforting kind of continuity to it. So this sort of preserved that continuity, right?
Absolutely. But according to the Smithsonian Museum, the weird thing is, now the Smithsonian, by the way, does have one of Rowetter's original bread slicers, the second iteration. Anyway, according to the Smithsonian, some people were just, sloppiness or staleness aside, some people were just weirded out by the idea of pre-sliced bread. It confused them. It startled them. A newspaper in 1928 said, quote, "The use of sliced bread may be startling to some people. Certainly, it represents a definite departure from the usual manner of supplying the consumer with baked loaves."
People don't like change. People fear change. It's so funny because now it's just, it's like, it's a cliche. The idea of saying the best thing since sliced bread being like one of the oldest innovations on the planet and the most just like taken for granted thing on the world, right? If you go to that, I'm sorry, AmericanHistory.si.edu article, The Best Loan Since Sliced Bread by Christina Ross, who's apparently an intern, a very scrappy intern, if I may say so, from 2013. So she's likely not an intern anymore. But there is a picture of the first ever Rowetter bread slicing machine. And it is a really serious piece of machinery. I mean, it's like a cotton gin or something. Like it's a really hardcore industrial piece of equipment. This isn't something that you would like have in your living room. This is very much like a tool of industry.
Yeah, it does not look like it's for the home kitchen. It also looks heavy as heck.
Mm-hmm.
There's something I think the three of us really enjoyed here in the research. Gabe pointed this out that, since this seems so unfamiliar and alien to people, they actually took out ads that included, get this, instructions for how to operate the loaf of bread. Did you see these?
No. Lay it on me, Ben.
Okay. It's a three-step process. And this is verbatim from the ad. Number one, open wrapper at one end. Number two, pull out pin. That's that U-shaped pin. Number three, remove as many slices as desired. I guess some people thought you could only pull out one slice at a time. Maybe some people, I don't know, man, were people like opening both ends of the wrapper and just sort of like punching it through the cylinder? Anyway, we've all seen these weird instructions and products for stuff that kind of seems easy. Not to sound elitist, but you know, I don't know. Have you ever seen things that feel kind of like dummy instructions on things you buy?
You know, Ben, I have. But at the same time, I think we take for granted how dumb some people truly are.
Oh, yeah. I never take for granted how dumb I am. And I'm one of the dumbest people I know.
Ben, that is not true. You need to give yourself more credit than my friend. I won't stand for it.
Oh, man. Well, thank you. Thank you. I stand on the shoulders of giants.
This self-deprecating behavior will not stand, sir.
Thanks. So the thing is that the pin turned out to be a problem. And we, you know, you'll look at your local loaf in your grocery store or your kitchen, and you'll notice that it does not, in fact, have two U-shaped pins holding the loaf together. People were having a problem because you would have to take the pin out, take a slice of bread, and then put the pin back in. It was an extra step, and people didn't really like it. So Roeder modified the machine, and now all the sliced loaves were just wrapped in wax paper. So it still solves the problem of them looking sloppy, because nobody wants to just buy a pile of bread, I guess, was the problem. But then it also takes that pin out. And I got to tell you, as you guys know, I'm real weird about metal touching food. So I think I honestly would have been one of those people who saw sliced bread in the store in the 1920s and thought, no way, this is ungodly.
Mm-mm. And also all this talk of pulling out and putting back in pins make me think this loaves of bread were somehow like explosive or something. I don't know. Like bread grenades.
Yeah. I think it's an idea. Come on, man. Let's bread grenades might be, you know what, people listening to this years from now might be like, God, those guys were prescient.
No. The new phrase will be the best thing since bread grenades.
There we go. Put it on a t-shirt. Let's get some new t-shirts. I like that.
I will if the printing shops ever open back up again.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Well, at least in the story of Roeder, we know that he ultimately, after years of laborious loaf-related labor, found success, and bread sales skyrocketed. More and more people weren't just eating sliced bread. They were eating more bread in general than ever before. Like, within 5 years after 1928, tons of bakeries across the United States had bread slicing machines, and 80% of all of the bread produced in the entire country came sliced.
It's true. But I'll tell you, Ben, there's nothing like an innovation taking off and making people happy to get the government up in arms and ready to ban it.
You are so right, my friend.
Hey, my name's Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of On Purpose. I just had a great conversation with Michael B. Jordan, and you can listen to it right now. Michael is known for his performances in both film and television. His breakout role was in Fruitvale Station, playing Oscar Grant, which earned him widespread praise and numerous award nominations. His portrayal of Killmonger in Marvel's Black Panther, one of my favorites, further solidified his status as one of Hollywood's leading actors, earning him widespread acclaim for his complex and compelling performance. In our conversation, Michael really opens up. You're going to love listening to it, and I can't wait for you to check it out.
The closest to getting what you want is always the hardest. It's always the feeling when you're getting ready to, you know, people give up right before they get what they've always wanted to get. People quit.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart's Outspoken Network for a year, and what a year it has been. Every weekday, I navigate our rapidly changing world alongside our series of fabulous expert guests. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Woke not just to the latest headlines, but also to the collective power we all have. Woke to the need to build community with those around us. Woke to how to avoid burnout, and woke to the ways we can all find joy in the madness. Make Woke AF Daily with Danielle Moody your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. And tune in to hear the ways I am working to stay grounded amidst it all. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Fast forward, 1943. People still love bread. 1943, everybody loves bread. They love it sliced, too. Except for there's one guy who's got a beef with it. His name is Claude R. Wickard. He is the head of the War Foods Administration. He's also the Secretary of Agriculture. And on January 18th, 1943, for some reason, he bans pre-sliced bread.
He had a beef with pre-sliced bread. He was old school. You know, maybe he didn't like metal either. It's really unclear. Let's see if we can get to the bottom of why he had such a problem. He did that on January 18th of 1943. The specific reasons, they're not clear at all.
That's not even the now. Issue.
Not even now. It's a total mystery. There's speculation that he felt as though it was a matter of conserving resources during wartime. Right. Because he was the War Foods Administration. So he claimed that there was something to do with conserving wax paper, wheat, and steel.
Yeah. Okay. So this is weird. This is some real Grinch level thinking. And this guy was kind of playing a Grinch, whatever his motivations were. So the War Food Administration was created entirely to make sure there was enough food to feed the civilian population and enough food to feed the military abroad. And they wanted to prevent food waste. Food waste is still a huge problem here in 2020. So Claude says, you know what? My beef with sliced bread is that people like it too much. And it's too easy for people to eat as much as they want. So banning sliced bread makes the loaf a little more inconvenient. But that wasn't enough for him. He also made a very strange authoritarian law for local bakeries. And this one is massively irritating to me.
Yeah, it's true. He said that local bakeries could not sell their bread, their unsliced bread, until it was 12 hours old.
Gross.
So wait, so you're like legally mandating us, and by us, I mean the royal us, the us of the time, to stale day-old bread, which usually you buy at a discount. I mean, bread is meant to be, you know, obviously, like I said, with the preservatives of the stuff you buy in the store, certainly you could never expect it to be like, you know, fresh out of the oven. But if you're buying it at a bakery, you want it fresh out of the oven, damn it.
Right. You want that fluffy, fresh taste. The reason that they put in this crazy law is that Uncle Sam thought if all the bread you were going to buy was going to be stale, then people would stop buying as much, and maybe they would even resort to baking their own bread at home or give it up entirely, meaning there was more wheat, more grain, more bread to circulate in the wartime population. That's so messed up, man.
It seems to really target small businesses,
mm-hmm.
You know, like that's literally trying to cripple them in their supply chain, which, I mean, whatever, you know, desperate times and all that. But it seems a little draconian, don't you think?
I 100% agree. We still, like, as we just said, we still don't fully understand the ban, but we know that it might have come because There was a 10% rise in the price of flour anyway. It's strange. You can see the logic, right? They thought that they would be able to incentivize people to eat less bread and consume less flour. But what about the wax paper conservation? So pre-sliced bread had to use wax paper that was way thicker than the loaves that were sold whole. And that was because, you know, again, they were trying to preserve the freshness and keep it from growing stale.
So that was wrapped in wax paper. So it wasn't like in a plastic sleeve like we see today with a bread tie. It was literally the whole thing was just wrapped in wax paper.
Yeah. That replaced the pin. And you know, other unsliced loaves also had wax paper, but they had much thinner wax paper. And so the thing that's weird about this is that bread companies already had a ton of wax paper supplies. They're like those people who hoard toilet paper. They had enough wax paper to keep them wrapping loaves for months and months, even if they didn't buy anything else. So it really seems like there wasn't a big thing to, like a big benefit to gain from banning wax paper. The wheat flour argument makes a little bit more sense, but even that doesn't check out. I mean, this is why some historians say it was maybe more an issue of conserving metal. Because like you said, Noel, those electric bread slicing machines are heavy duty, huh?
That's true. I mean, they really do almost look like a implement of war. You could probably make, you know, a handful of machine guns, you know, with the materials you would use to make one bread slicing machine. And at the end of the day, isn't it just kind of a luxury? You know, I'm trying to see both sides here. Like, there's really nothing about, if anything, I would think maybe slicing bread does make it go bad quicker because there's more touch points, right? Mm-hmm. And every time you reach in there, you're touching the bread. I don't know. I'm overthinking this. But I do think that, you know, sliced bread is a luxury. And even today, sure, I guess it's convenient. But when I buy my bread from the baker or like a baguette or something, I don't get it pre-sliced. I slice it my damn self.
Yeah, I tend to like the bakery bread more than the sliced bread on the shelf. Not to be elitist or something, but it's just like if I have the opportunity, then I'll try to get what in my head I call the good bread. You know what? Everybody has something like
that. Yeah, a good steamy loaf.
A good steamy loaf. In context, that's exactly what I'm talking about. Out of context, oh, I wonder if
something else entirely.
Yeah, I wonder if that clip's going to come back to haunt us the way that this policy came back to haunt Claude Wickard.
God, you're good at these, Ben. Segues, that is.
Oh, thanks, man. It's true, though, isn't it? Like, even though we can guess at what he was trying to do, it really looks like he was just trying to save a couple pennies in the budget, and he had to pay a grievous price for this because people did not take this well.
Oh, yeah, that's putting it lightly. I mean, it was, you know, people don't like to have the things taken away from them that they have become accustomed to, that in their minds is a natural born right, the right to sliced bread. Everybody remembers that one from the Constitution. But no, at the very least, it was incredibly unpopular. On January 26th, Sue Forrester, who is a woman from Fairfield, Connecticut, wrote a letter to the editor in the Times, the New York Times, and she was speaking on behalf of all of the country's housewives. We have this from an article from Mental Floss, the time U.S. government banned sliced bread. And she says, I quote, "I should like to let you know how important sliced bread is to the morale and saneness of a household." Okay. The morale and saneness of a household. They really didn't like slicing that bread, did they?
Yeah. And they go into detail about this. Sue Forrester says she's been forced to hand cut more than 30 slices of bread every day for her family. She says this is a waste of American time and energy. And it's also a waste of money because, you know, she says a good bread knife is difficult to find, let alone afford during the war. That's
not to mention a good man.
There we go, right? Oh, what about our marriage prospects? So people got as mad at this ban as they did at things like gasoline rationing. We have an account from a 1943 issue of Time where they have the following excerpt. U.S. housewives, says Time, vainly search for grandmother's serrated bread knife, routed sleepy husbands out of bed, held dawn conferences over bakery handouts which read like a golf lesson. Keep your head down, keep your eye on the loaf, and don't bear down. Time was basically saying a bunch of people had forgotten how to slice a loaf of bread.
I think we buried the loaf here. Keep your eye on the loaf.
Yeah.
That is some very powerful rhetoric right there. It's got me all full of fervor and patriotism.
Yeah. And this is interesting because this leads us to the saying that we all know today. Because of this ban, people started referring to things as the best thing since sliced bread.
That's true. Nothing will make you appreciate something more than when it's taken away from you. And the New York Times published more than one letter from other very crestfallen housewives, homemakers, and it really became kind of part of the zeitgeist that this was a real blow to morale during a very difficult time already.
Yeah. In fact, it was so unpopular that no one in the U.S. government wanted to confess to having the idea or supporting it. So Claude Wickard was really caught out there, you know? He was going to be the scapegoat in this situation.
Oh, and okay, all of my trash talk about bread slicing, I want to walk that back a little bit. I am not a head of household with multiple children that has to be responsible for meal prep. And let's not forget the sandwich, the humble sandwich was kind of the centerpiece for a lot of these grab-and-go meals. So let's get a little deeper into this letter to the editor from our Connecticut housewife. She goes on to say, "My husband and four children are all in a rush before, during, and after breakfast. Without ready sliced bread, I must do the slicing for toast. 2 pieces for each one. That's 10. For their lunches, I must cut by hand at least 20 slices. For 2 sandwiches apiece." They get 2 sandwiches apiece. That's intense.
It was a different time.
It really was. "Afterward, I make my own toast. 22 slices of bread to be cut in a hurry. They look less appetizing than the baker's neat, even pieces. Haven't the bakers already their bread slicing machines? And for thousands of loaves?"
Yeah, and she's coming from a real sincere, upset place. Like you said, she's not the only one.
I didn't think about the numbers. I didn't think about the math behind this. That's a lot of bread slicing.
And the numbers add up really quickly.
All right.
So another thing that made this rule so unpopular was that it caught everybody by surprise. The Chicago Tribune reported, "The governmental ban on the sale of sliced bread, effective yesterday, caught hundreds of Chicago housewives by surprise and sent them scurrying to hardware stores to raid depleted supplies of bread knives." I don't know why he sounds like that, but that's the guy.
Oh, no, it's absolutely the guy. I remember the newscasts.
Now, there were some loopholes. So hotels, restaurants, and railroad dining cars were given a 60-day grace period to prepare. Bakeries that didn't play ball or toe the line got hit with some pretty steep fines, and they were warned that the government was prepared to take stern measures if necessary. But some other proponents seemed like they quickly regretted their decision. That's where we gotta mention this one guy just because I love his name, Emil Fink.
I bet he got a bad rap for like being like a scoundrel. You know, you can't have a last name like that and emerge unscathed. Yes, Emil Fink. He was a baker. And also a member of the New York City Bakers Advisory Committee. And actually, he was kind of the villain here. He's the one who pushed hard for the bread slicing ban. But a year later, Fink found himself in a courtroom, forget this, slicing bread.
Talk about a
hypocrite. Bad look. Yeah. The New York Times reported that a U.S. attorney read Fink the Riot Act and said Fink called upon the government to enforce the regulation rigidly, and at the very time his bakery was violating the law, he was fined $1,000. You want to inflation calculate that, B-boy? I'm going to say $5,000.
Let's see. So, Casey, if we could get a drum roll, please. $1,000 in 1944 is equal to $14,697.61 today.
I was way off. And that's a pretty steep penalty, but I think he had it coming for that that most egregious sin of hypocrisy.
Yeah, yeah. And Baker, like, it makes you think that Fink had, God, I feel bad. I feel like it's nominative determinism to call him Fink.
Totally.
But it feels like his angle was that he wanted to make sure he was one of the only bakeries selling sliced bread to get ahead. He was trying to make a vig, I think.
Despicable.
But the ban wasn't even saving money at all. Like, bakers were losing cash because of this.
Oh, yeah, it's true. The sales were dropping in the neighborhood of 5%, as much as 10%, according to the Harrisburg Telegraph. There's a quote from that article from 1943 in February. While all bakers have varied reasons for the prevailing decrease, they all agree that the absence of sliced bread is at least playing some part in the drop. Where's our boy Otto in all of this?
That's a great question, because Otto was very much alive. He lived until November 8th, 1960. So he definitely had, I'm sure he had strong thoughts about this. He was, you know, this was his career. He sold the patent to his invention to another company. Like, he was doing pretty well off. So he definitely had a race in the game, but he had already made his nickels by the time this kicks in.
That's right.
Is that a thing people say, make your nickels?
No, that's a thing, but I'll tell you what isn't a thing is he already had his race in the game. I think you were combining skin in the game with horse in the race.
Oh, man.
Race, you know, in the game.
Let's keep it.
I love it. No, I think we should use that. That should be our new thing. He already had a race in the game. I really, really like that a lot, actually.
Oh, thanks, man. Thanks for the catch. It's wild over here, folks.
No worries, dude. Hey, we got to keep each other honest while we're slowly losing our mind in isolation.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, hopefully it will be to the enjoyment of you, dear, dear ridiculous historians. We have a little bit more to add here, which is that the ban was thankfully lifted only 3 months after it went into law, right? It was like March in 1943, I want to say.
Mm-hmm, that's right. It was lifted, and there was a public statement made from the War Production Board. And it actually, you know, to its credit, kind of copped to the thing being a failure, saying, quote, savings are not as much as were expected. Oh, leaving it at that. And that there was enough wax paper to go around and wrap sliced bread for 4 months. So, mm-hmm. You know, bully for them for sort of owning their debacle.
Hey, my name's Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of On Purpose. I just had a great conversation with Michael B. Jordan, and you can listen to it right now. Michael is known for his performances in both film and television. His breakout role was in Fruitvale Station, playing Oscar Grant, which earned him widespread praise and numerous award nominations. His portrayal of Killmonger in Marvel's Black Panther, one of my favorites, further solidified his status as one of Hollywood's leading actors, earning him widespread acclaim for his complex and compelling performance. In our conversation, Michael really opens up. You're going to love listening to it, and I can't wait for you to check it out.
The closest to getting what you want is always the hardest. It's always the feeling when you're getting ready to, you know, people give up right before they get what they've always wanted to get. People quit.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Abusers in Hollywood are as old as the Hollywood sign itself. And while fame is the ultimate prize in Tinseltown, underneath it lies a shroud of mystery. Binge this season of Variety Confidential from Variety, Hollywood's number one entertainment news source and iHeart Podcasts. 6 episodes are waiting for you right now to dive into what lies beneath the glitzy image of Hollywood's golden age and all the sex, money, and murder that's been swept under the rug for decades. Using the Variety archives, each episode offers a rare glimpse into little-known casting couch stories that have long lived in the shadows. So join us as we navigate the tangled web of Hollywood's secret history with host Tracy Patton, along with expert Variety reporters and correspondents, as they discuss the secret history of the casting couch to explore the scandalous history of Hollywood's casting process. Listen to Variety Confidential on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You know, if we could, I think a good place to put a button and a bow on this story is a great headline from the New York Times. When the ban was lifted, the New York Times published an article reading, "Sliced bread put back on sale. Housewives' thumbs safe again."
Thank God.
Thank God. Think of the thumbs, all the thumbs.
Oh, yeah. I mean, at the very least, they're getting nicked left and right. I would love to see some statistics about how many outright severed thumbs occurred at the hands of unsliced bread.
I mean, that slice math really gets to you, you know? I'm glad you put that in. Oh, I want to say before we end today's episode, guys, I want to do a clarification. Because, you know, credit where credit's due is very important to me. And earlier in a previous episode, we went on this delightful little run of Quentin Tarantino-based quarantine puns. You remember that?
I'm going to be real with you guys. They weren't very good. Can we do better this time? Can we raise the bar?
Well, I wanted to credit one of our friends on Twitter, because you guys said, oh, Quentin Quarantino is pretty good.
That one's good. That one's
it
good.
Got me thinking, and I was like, did I make that up? Because that's really good for someone like me to make up on the fly. And I wanted to give a shout out. I think I found this and just misremembered it on Twitter. We have a Twitter friend who goes by the handle Quentin Quarantino. So Kelthy, @Kelthy_, if you're out there, thank you so much. I wanted to give you credit where credit was due, because I think it just got stuck in my head. I love that name.
It happens, and that's true. Well, thank you so much, Kelthy. Is it Kelsey, and you just developed a lisp all of a sudden, or is it
no? Nope.
Kelthy. Okay.
Kelthy.
That's interesting. It makes me feel like I'm speaking with a lisp. Well, this was a fun episode, Ben. Can we take a minute? I don't know. I just had this idea to find an object that's around you somewhere in your workspace and describe it to the listeners.
Yeah. Here. Let's see. I'm in a weird spot. You want to do the honors?
Yeah, I've got one just in mind. It's something I bought at a a cheapo dollar store. It's a WWF or E miniature figures, and they're like little mini wrestlers, just Jake the Snake and the Ultimate Warrior and this guy wearing chains, and they're all completely flesh nude colored. Here, let me show you guys so you can actually see.
Oh, nice.
But they're called Muscle, but it's an acronym. And you know how much I love acronyms. So there's a dot between every one of these letters, and it stands for Millions of Unusual Small Creatures Lurking Everywhere. That's not sinister at all.
They didn't. So it sounds like the O is not part of the acronym there.
They often leave the O. It's usually only the capitalized letters in a title, right? The O is there's a word for it. But yeah, okay, so that's my object.
Okay, I've got something that I just dug up that I think you'll like here, Noel. I've been cleaning up a bunch of stuff, and I found, how weirdly synchronistic is this? I found my old shoebox of Muscle Men. Do you remember these guys?
Muscle Men?
Yeah, you know what I'm talking about?
Are they kind of like My Little Muscle Guys?
Yeah.
They're exactly the same.
School, I think they might be the same. This is an old school kind of toy. I think some of our listeners will remember.
But they're nude colored. They're flesh colored. They're all flesh colored, just like My Little Guys.
Yeah. Oh, I've got some that are like, I don't know what color this is, but I've got some
blue.
That are like that.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And then I've got some knockoff ones. That's so weird that we both have.
That's really funny. And they're the most useless little toys. They don't bend or pose.
No,
they're really
points
just kind
of
articulation. Choking hazards is what they are, really.
Yeah, but they're stylish. I thought that would be more fun than looking at the dehydrated food I have. That we recorded another show today, folks, for Stuff They Want You to Know with our ride or dies, Paul Mission Control and Matt Frederick. Where we were talking about some of the things in our quarantine zones. But that's a fun game, man. You wanna make that a regular thing?
I don't know. It's just kind of fun to humanize our spaces and show that we're just nerds like everybody else, and that we have cluttered, messy desks just like everybody else. Casey, did you find anything in your closet space?
All right. Well, this space is primarily for books and movies and camera equipment. So I don't really have anything endearing like a figurine, a toy or something in here. But I did find this book. It's by Otessa Moshfegh. It's called My Year of Rest and Relaxation. And it came out maybe a couple years ago. And it's about a woman who, through pharmaceutical means, decides that she's going to sleep for an entire year. So, I don't know. I thought that was an appropriate pick for a current quarantine situation.
I bet there, I would be down with that, at least for a couple of maybe weeks or maybe a month or so. But yeah, wow. Very, very appropriate for these are plague times.
It reminds me of that sleep study that was going around for a while where they would pay participants to lay prone for like 30 or 90 days. I had a friend who got really close to actually doing that.
That sounds awful.
Yeah, you had to lay down. That was the rule. You had to always be laying down because they wanted to see what kind of horrible things would happen to your body. Isn't that nuts?
I mean, bed sores, basically, right?
Bed sores, you probably lose muscle tone, I bet, because you're not walking around. But let's not end on that note. Let's end on a big thank you. So thank you not just to Otto, but thanks to everybody for tuning in. You know, we hope you're healthy. We hope you're happy. We hope that if you are hanging out on the internet, like a lot of us are these days, that you drop our digital way and say hello to us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, not just as our show, Ridiculous History, but also say hello to us as individuals. We're online a lot.
It's true. You can find me exclusively on Instagram at How Now Noel Brown, where you can follow my quarantine-y situation. I might be posting some of these ambient dreamscape guitar pieces that I've been sort of talking about here and there. So stay tuned for that on my stories.
And you can find me at Ben Bolin, HSW, on Twitter. I've been fielding a lot of questions about prepping or survival kind of situations. I'm always around to answer those. And I'm also updating to the minute with developments, both here and at another show called Strange News Daily. So do check it out. You can see my misadventures on Instagram at Ben Bolin. I fell for starting to post a lot of memes. I'm sorry, you know, I know the world's in a real troubled place, but the memes, they give me light and love in troubled times, you know?
Same, my friend, and I always find light and love all over your stories and your feed, my friend, and I appreciate that very much. And please do check out Strange News Daily for a daily dose of exactly what the show name implies, Strange News in These Are Strange Times.
Oh, man, thank you so much. We'll see how it works out. Quick peek behind the curtain, by the way, in addition to doing our show Ridiculous History, that's very near and dear to our hearts, the three of us are continually making a ton of other shows, and we don't always shout them out because we don't, you know, we want to make sure each one is special, but we also, we sometimes, at least for you guys, sometimes I lose track of which ones are already out and which ones are still secret. But I just want to say, and I hope you don't get mad at me about this, Noel, I just want to say that our my good friend Mr. Brown here has quite a few fascinating things on the way, including, of course, Dear Young Rocker. If you haven't checked that out, give it a listen.
Yeah, thanks, Ben. That one just wrapped up in partnership with Jake Brennan, who does the wonderful rock true crime kind of hybrid show Disgraceland. He has an imprint called Double Elvis that he has several shows partnering up with us on the iHeart Podcast Network, and one of them is Dear Young Rocker with Chelsea Ursin, who you saw or heard rather on the show very recently talking about the Ponzi scheme and the history of the Ponzi scheme. He also has another one that's really great that just came out called Citizen Critic, where Scott Yanovitz and Greg Connolly take on hot takes from professional and amateur critics alike. So it's a show where they critique the critics, and it's quite delightful. And that show is ongoing on the iHeart Podcast Network as we speak.
Last shout out. This is a fun one, and we want to mention it to you. You might hear it on our feed. Noel, you and I, a while back, when people could still travel more easily, you and I went on Food Court, which is the show we appeared on, made by our good pal Christopher Hasiotis, hosted by none other than Richard Blaze. That episode is coming out or should be out soon, and I listened to it. I don't know what you thought, Noel, but I thought it was a lot of fun. It was a good time.
I think I may have shouted that out previously and said that it was already out. That was not true. It is now, by this point, out in the world, I think, because it comes out on Tuesday of next week, and this episode also comes out on Tuesday of next week. So they should be dropping the same exact day. We debate with each other two sides of a very hot-button food issue. I took the side of sausage and you the side of bacon, and you'll have to listen to find out who came out on top. But it's a wonderful show. Richard Blaze is a fantastic host and judge, very fair. And I was really pleased that he actually followed me on Instagram, and I felt like $1 million. And he's been posting all these great isolation cooking videos on his stories.
Oh, yeah.
And he was making a something called a ramen latke.
I saw that.
Yeah, it looked really, really fantastic. And he's a really sweet guy. So check out Food Court with Richard Blaze.
His nachos are on point, too, if you're a food pick fanatic like me.
Yeah, and he has a chicken restaurant called Crack Shack that they don't have any around here, but it looks incredible. Talk about good-looking, decadent chicken sandwiches.
Yeah, he's my internet buddy now. We're hoping to get him on our show soon. So get a preview of our interaction by checking out Food Court. As always, thank you so much to our super producer, Casey Pegram. Casey, I'm going to find a book for our next quarantine spotting because I feel a little weird that you had something amazing and literate. And I was like, hey, look at my shoebox of toys. But thank you. Thank you, as always, for being the best half of our show. I'm not good at the math. But also, thank you, as always, to Gabe Luzier.
Gabe Luzier, indeed. And we hope to have him on very, very soon. Thanks to Jonathan Strickland, the Notorious Quizster. I think we already thanked Christopher Asiotis in talking about Food Court. Huge thanks to Alex Williams, who composed this very theme that you hear within your ear holes. And thanks to you, Ben, for being a pal and being a quarantine podcast mate. I really look forward to these times and look forward to keeping it rolling with you, sir.
Likewise, Noel. In the meantime, of course, as always, you know, We like to think that our show is a community. So if you want to contact us on a personal level, we always love to hear from you. Let us know how it's going in your neck of the woods. And let us know what your weirdest food history story is. We could read about this all day.
We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
This episode is brought to you by the movie The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, only in theaters April 19th. Get tickets now.
It's directed by Guy Ritchie, who did The Gentlemen, and produced by Jerry Bruckheimer, who did Top Gun Maverick.
Based on a true story, this action comedy reveals the first ever Special Forces mission executed during World War II.
Starring Henry Cavill and Alan Ritchson, discover how one mission changed history, laying the foundation for modern Black Ops warfare.
The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare is rated R and in theaters April 19th. Get tickets now.
This episode of Ridiculous History is brought to you by Avalon Waterways. Ben, are you in major need of a vacation right now?
Noel, you're a mind reader. I am, and aren't we all?
We are. While cruising remains popular, there's something big happening in the industry, and that is, my friend, smaller ships.
True story. The intimate ships of Avalon Waterways can go where the big ships can only dream, through winding passageways of rolling vineyards and castled hills into the heart of timeless cities and storybook villages.
That sounds like a delight. See how Avalon's smaller ships promise greater discoveries, fewer people, and more of everything.
Limited time special offers await at avalonwaterways.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts. But we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.